50 years ago, the mining village of Aberfan was the epicentre of the biggest disaster in Welsh history. 4 million cubic feet of debris fell from a coal slurry pit on the mountaintop, demolishing everything in its path, including 18 houses, a farm, and the local school. 144 people were killed instantly, including 116 children and 28 adults. It was October 21st, 1966, at 9:15 a.m. The children of Pantglass School had just finished their last assembly of the term. They were due to go on a week's holiday that afternoon. It took just 10 minutes for millions of tons of coal slurry to descend down the mountain, causing such devastation and tragedy. Despite numerous petitions from parents and teachers and locals in Aberfan, with concerns of safety for the school being in such close proximity to this man-made mountain of coal slurry, that day saw not only the biggest disaster, but one of the biggest scandals Wales had ever seen. Fifty years on, and the Aberfan disaster is not forgotten in Wales. Many still cannot talk about what happened. After family, friends, and their own children lost, these memories stick with them forever. Welcome to a special episode of Think Tank. In this episode, interviews have been conducted by Dan Hurd, Welsh language coordinator here at Express Radio. Our first interview is with Amy Goddard, a singer-songwriter who knows a lot about Aberfan. Here's what she had to say.
So I'm here now with Amy Goddard, a singer-songwriter who's recently done a commemorative song for the 50th anniversary of the Aberfan disaster. Amy, great to have you here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Firstly, what was behind your decision to make this this track?
Well, I grew up in the Merthyr Valley, so I went past the scene of the accident on my way to school every day. I went to school in Troiderut, which is the next village. And so it's something that's always been in my consciousness. And what with it being the 50th anniversary, I thought it might be a fitting time to write something as a bit of a memorial to the victims.
Absolutely. We've spoken to a few people so far contributing for this podcast, mm-hmm. Who've all been affected in different ways by their research and their looking back at the disaster. How did it affect you doing this performance?
I think doing the research was probably, for it was probably the hardest thing, because I read all the eyewitness accounts and all the accounts of the survivors and the rescue workers, and also the findings of the tribunal and everything, and I found that all very, very moving. And then it's a question of trying to get something into a song that you can sing as well without becoming too emotional, because obviously that's not going to help if you're actually trying to sing something in a live situation. So it's trying to find the right parts of the story to tell. So yeah.
Have you been back to Aberfan since recording this?
I have actually. Yes, I went up there and visited the graveyards and visited the memorial gardens, and also went up to the other side of the valley and took a couple of video shots across the valley where you can see where it happened and everything. That's going to go along with the song.
That's been very, very moving to be there.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it really was.
So do you think the now that it's the 50th anniversary coming up next month, that the focus once again is on Aberfan, that it hasn't really gone away in effect, that kind of focus?
I think for the people who live there, they don't think the focus has ever gone away. I think, the village has obviously been so marked by the events, and obviously there are still survivors who are living there and in other areas. Some of the survivors, I believe, moved away because it was too difficult to stay in that area. There is still a charity as well that operates that maintains the memorial gardens and everything, and I know it gets a lot of international visitors even, because it's something that was really known all over the world, wasn't it, when it actually happened. And so many people I've said to about it said things like, I remember where I was when I heard about that. And it's a bit, it was before my time, but it's a bit like I remember where I was when the Twin Towers came down. And I think it was sort of a disaster on that sort of level in at the time.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. It was the first probably televised disaster. So many people,
absolutely.
My parents and grandparents' generation would have seen on TV.
Exactly, yes.
The media kind of, some have argued they kind of jumped on it a bit, some have argued they overexposed it a bit. Do you feel that was the case at the time?
I think it was a newsworthy event, and the world needed to know what had happened there because, I mean, some of the sort of health and safety protections we have now are actually because of terrible mistakes that were made at that time, and those changes needed to happen. So it was good that the world knew about it from that point of view. I think it's a question of... it's a question of doing things in a way that's respectful to the victims, isn't it? And I think probably some in the media and some photographers probably took advantage of that. But it's, I suppose, at the end of the day, they do have a job to report on what's happening. I suppose it's a question of doing it in a way that's not callous, isn't it?
Yes,
I have heard some stories.
Yeah.
I have heard some stories of people sort of saying, make the child cry so I can get a picture and things like that. And you think, and that's awful. But contrary to that, I've also heard of, reporters who were really, really moved by the events and who actually pitched in and helped and became a little bit part of the community as well because they reported on, things that happened in the next few months as well. So
absolutely. Mm. Do you feel Aberfan's always going to be now a community that's going to be going to be summed up really by this disaster, sort of be linked with that in a way?
I think it's going to be synonymous with the disaster.
Yes.
I think it is going to be synonymous with the disaster. That said, having grown up in the area and gone to school in the area, I mean, I sort of knew a bit about the Aberfan disaster, but when I started senior school at 11 in the next village, we used to go past Aberfan all the time, and I didn't really think about it.
Didn't resonate at the time,
no, it didn't. It didn't at the time because I knew that something terrible had happened there a long time ago. But it was a long time ago, and I learnt to swim in the leisure centre, which was built with the money that was, donated.
Yes.
To and just just next to the site of where
because
the school came down.
All in from around the world. At the time,
exactly, they absolutely did. So. I learnt to swim there, so I knew of it as a swimming pool and a leisure centre. In fact, we held our wedding reception in the main hall of that leisure centre. So it's an area I've known for other things. But I was always aware of the disaster as well. Although we didn't really study it in school. And I think with the 50th anniversary, as I said, I really started to research it in a bit more depth. And it resonated with me an awful lot more since I've actually sat down and I've read all the newspaper reports from the time and the eyewitness accounts and things. And yeah, it's certainly found much more meaning for me since I've actually taken the time to do that. So maybe for the generation that saw it happen, Aberfan will always be synonymous with that. But for the younger generation who, weren't born until, some years afterwards, then maybe it's not in their consciousness as much.
Absolutely. I was reading the other day about how in America now, college freshmen are going to start learning about 9/11 as a historic event,
right.
Something they weren't even alive for. Something started.
Yes, wow.
Aberfan was 50 years ago, but it needs to be remembered.
Oh, it does. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And it was, it was such a preventable tragedy as well. That's the other thing. It was sort of a certain amount of greed and lack of care and lack of maintenance and partly lack of knowledge. They didn't realise quite how bad it could have been. And even one of the workers actually said it had never entered his head. When he saw it go, it never entered his head that it could have reached as far as the village. For it to have gone down as far as that, I mean, that's the thing, tips did slip and move. But for it to have gone as far as it did, it was just, they were staggered. But then it shouldn't have been built as big. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
In the song itself, Remembering Aberfan, are you singing from the point of view of a real person? Or
It's not a specific real person. There was a contact that my dad has in the area. It was once somebody who was helped a lot with the St John's Ambulance.
Yes.
And I don't actually know the gentleman's name, but he helped a lot with St John's Ambulance. Recovering the dead and looking for survivors. And he told my dad a story about a mother who was racked with guilt because the little lad hadn't wanted to go to school that day. And she'd insisted, as you would, you'd insist that the child went to school. And then that happened, and that, I presume, would have made her feel even more guilty. And so, as I said, I don't know who that person was. It's only a third-person sort of story, but that's something that resonated with me, and I thought, it's like people who weren't on at 9/11 because they missed the bus or they missed the train and stuff. And sometimes, just how events unfold And, you know, if he had stayed home that day, maybe he'd have been okay. And it's also the fact that it was the last day of term, because it was the last day of term before the... So, and they were only in school that day until 12. Yes. So if it happened just a few hours later, the death toll would have been so much smaller. And, so not a specific person, but it is told in the first person, and it's based on that story.
There's been some very interesting poetry and songs and performances made about the First World War and about Aberfan. Do you feel that we as the Welsh, as a culture, we can express grief and sorrow in such a poetic kind of way?
Yes, absolutely. I think, the Welsh have got a strong tradition of song, haven't they? And and I think that's an important part of the culture, absolutely. And it's good to be able to remember these events. And, song can be just something that's pleasant to listen to and background music, or it can just be, you know, your typical love songs, and there's place for that and everything. But sometimes a song that tells a story can really actually stop and make people think. And I think that's a nice for the memory of the people who are involved.
Absolutely. And where is the song available to be downloaded from?
The Remembering Aberfan song, it's available on my website, which is amygoddardmusic.co.uk. And from the 3rd of October, it will also be on all the normal places like iTunes and Amazon and everything else. But all the proceeds from that are going to the Aberfan Memorial Disaster Trust, which is basically the charity that maintains the area and keeps it looking respectable and respectful for people to visit.
Well, that's excellent. Thank you so much, Amy Goddard.
No problem. Thank you very much.
That was Amy Goddard talking to Dan Hurd. She talks about how the news of Aberfan back then resonated around the world, and people today still say, "I remember where I was when I heard about this news." Much like the more recent 9/11 disaster. She also talks about how Aberfan was reported back then and the questionable journalism that may have taken place. She mentioned photographers asking children to cry to make the story more dramatic. Methods like these, which still happen today. Our next guest is author Louise Walsh, and she too brings up the morals of the press back then in her book. Here's what she had to say.
So I'm here with Louise Walsh, the writer of Black River. So Louise, would you tell me a bit about the plot to start off with then?
Yeah, so it's based on a lot of research, but the plot is about a South Wales Echo journalist who is incensed really by the Fleet Street Press reporting on Aberfan in a sensational manner. So he has this plan to go along with the Welsh office that they'll run this Lay Off Aberfan campaign. And in the pursuit of this quixotic campaign, he starts to take a look at journalism in a broader sense and decides to try and expose some of the Fleet Street journalists. So
fantastic. What was it about Aberfan that inspired you to write a novel where it's at the forefront of the plot?
Do you know, it's funny because I was researching a very different novel, and it was about Cardiff's Irish community in 1967. So that's where the year came in. And in researching that, I was reading more widely. And I suppose it was a combination of things. One, I came across the idea that there might be a problem with the press at Aberfan, which was interesting because Leveson was on in the background. And I was interested in their ethical dilemmas unfolding with Leveson. And the other thing was that I realised I didn't really know as much as I probably should do about Aberfan. So when I was reading about it, and it's so shocking, and I realised that I hadn't really ever learnt about Aberfan in school. Maybe I think it probably came up in junior school. But you can't take on the significance and the horror of it all when you're in junior school. And I think they tend to teach you when you're of a similar age to the children at Aberfan. And so you kind of draw pictures about it, things like that. But the real trauma and the horror of it and the scale of it really hit home when I was reading the book. So I just got carried off on that story then.
Absolutely. Well, it's set in the 60s, and much of the action takes place in and around Thompson House, yeah, which is where the home of the Western Mail and the Echo at the time. What was it like to kind of like delve into that a different world in terms of like journalism at such a crucial yet tragic time in Welsh history?
Do you know, it was fascinating. And I had some help from Cardiff University to start off with, because it seemed overwhelming that I would try and reconstruct Thompson House and go back to the 1960s. And I met with Professor Bob Franklin at Cardiff University, and he gave me this massive reading list. And so I started there, and I started with the history of journalism, really, from the 1960s to now, just to get that sort of background. And then I went into the research. And with Thompson House, I was lucky enough to go through the microfiche document, and I came across some celebratory issues when they'd moved to Thompson House from St. Mary Street in 1961. So I found two celebration magazines, really, with all the information about Thompson House. So I was able to reconstruct it from those.
That's amazing. Did you have any like apprehensions before you began writing about the subject of Aberfan, how certain things could be perceived or interpreted by survivors?
Yes, yes. But it wasn't so much because I knew the angle I was going in at, and I knew that I was very much on the side of the village, having read what I'd read. So I knew where I was coming from. But when you explain it to people, I'm going to write a book about Aberfan, the amount of people who went, what, or do you know what you're doing, or have you asked permission? So I knew the sensitivities from the reaction, and a lot of people were cautious, let's say, and wondering why I was going to do it, and what was my motivation behind it. But of course I knew that I was coming at it from a very sensitive position, and the fact that I found new information about Aberfan and what that village had been through made me really passionate to finish that story.
Oh, fantastic. In your previous work, Fighting Pretty, you blended aspects and locations from your own life with history and other events. Were there any memories or experiences from Aberfan that you were told about on your mind when you wrote Black River?
Do you know, I think the key thing is that when I was saying that I was writing a novel about Aberfan, everybody, it's one of those key moments, like JFK,
yeah.
Everybody knows where they were, and it's incredible, and it's amazing listening to those stories, everybody, and even when people were children, and they'd say, I heard about Aberfan when I was six, but I remember my mother crying, I remember asking my mother why, and all those stories. And again, you just realise the impact of Aberfan, and it was huge. It was up there. Well, it's one of the biggest Welsh disasters ever.
Absolutely, yeah. The novel seems to strike a balance between the genres of historical fiction and investigative journalism. Was that your aim from the beginning?
The aim from the beginning was the investigative journalism has come in recently, and I'm really happy about that because it's a novel about journalism. But I didn't think about it in those terms. I did think about it in terms of historical fiction, and it just fits in. I think it 1970s, anything before 1970s counts as historical fiction, so I just creep in at 1967. But the investigative journalism, and I suppose looking at it, I did investigate in order that my character can investigate. So it's funny, I sort of paved the way for Harry, really, on that one.
Well, speaking of Harry, the character of Harry Robert is certainly a bit of a tragic figure, I found, anyway, and that he's haunted by not only what happened at Aberfan, but his own coverage, or lack of it, of the tragedy. Were there journalists at the time who felt this way, and did you base him on anyone in particular?
No, and this was, I think, the thing that shocked me most, was that he was not based on anybody. Mm-hmm. And I wrote the character thinking, are people going to buy this, that this journalist went there and he was traumatized, you know, suffering from post-traumatic stress? And I thought, are people going to buy this? Is it going to have any basis in reality? And so I wasn't sure. I thought maybe that's where I'm going to get some criticism. No journalist would ever feel like that. And it was only recently at the conference at Cardiff Journalism School that I realized how many journalists felt that way, and how many journalists just hadn't talked about that, but they'd been really profoundly affected, and some hadn't been able to write about it and interview people in the way that their jobs would have required them to do because they were so overwhelmed with the situation. So yeah, it was, but I found that very emotional, actually, the fact that I thought it was a complete work of fiction and then reality is just very similar.
Absolutely. There are almost two kinds of submersions in the novel, the disaster itself, and then the masses and the press kind of descending on the scene. The first obviously had a massive, devastating impact on the community and Wales as a whole. But what about the second, the press coverage? How did this impact us?
I think it's had a lasting effect on the village, in that the press coverage was so... By about the summer of 1967, I think the press coverage has started changing towards the village. And almost the story was how the village was divided and how it was a battlefield. And I think that made the villagers almost, I think, potentially read those stories and think, this is what my neighbours think of me, or this is what so-and-so next door is thinking, or somebody has said this to the press. And I think it magnified what was actually going on, all these terrible emotions and grief and sadness, and it magnified those and it made people very suspicious of each other and suspicious of the press as well. Mm-hmm. So I think, yes, it did lasting damage.
Absolutely. A key issue in the novel is that of press intrusion, as we've touched upon just now. Harry is keen to protect the people of Abervan from further media attention leading up to the first anniversary of the disaster. And recently had a series of talks here at Cardiff University about Abervan, where a number of esteemed journalists spoke about their experiences. And press intrusion came up there as well. What are your own feelings on that? Did they intrude, or were they just trying to do their jobs?
This is a very interesting question, actually, because for ages I thought it's press intrusion. Mm-hmm. And it was only very late in the research that I realised that the journalists were invited to all the public meetings. And so when parents were discussing the release of interim payments from the disaster fund, the journalists would be recording things. And of course, things were said at these meetings, fears were raised, and all this was recorded in the press. And it was only then that I thought, well, really, the journalists are being objective. They are reporting what they're witnessing, what they're hearing. But should they have been given that access in the first place? And they certainly wouldn't get that access today.
Definitely, no. You capture the feeling of being overwhelmed by the scale and the impact of the devastation in Harry's feelings of helplessness early on. Is that how you felt at times writing this? You know, overwhelmed by the sheer horror of it all, looking back?
Definitely, definitely. And that's why, with the cover, and the cover was done by an artist who lives around the corner from me, Sarah Richards. And I knew I wanted her to do the cover, but that figure in the centre of the cover, of just that rescuer who's bewildered. And yeah, I think anybody who really gets into Abervan and researches Abervan or talks to survivors at Abervan, you do get that sense of being lost with it all. It's so overwhelming, and the implications are so overwhelming, and what that village went through are so overwhelming. So yes, definitely that sort of central figure being overwhelmed with it all, yes.
Is it true that after writing a first draft, you extracted the dialogue and turned it into a script?
Yes.
Was that so it could be like properly examined and improved, or was it kind of like bringing this part fictional, part fact story to life in a way?
Yes, I have a sort of regimen, I suppose, of reworking drafts. And the other thing is it can get quite tiring, rewriting. And so I find it interesting to play with things and take them into a different format. And I found the script, turning it into a script, particularly helpful because it focuses you on the dialogue. And you have to make that dialogue work in a number of ways. So it has to further the story. And if you can, you can get multiple things going on in the story. So perhaps they're talking about one thing, but you know that the subplot is something else. And it's really interesting to think about it in terms of script and get as much out of the dialogue as possible and then pop it all back in. But then I'll do a similar thing for the descriptive passages. I will take all the description out, I'll look at it in isolation, and I'll put it back in. So it's as much a rewriting process as making the rewriting interesting for myself.
Mm-hmm. I was reading something the other day about how the September 11 attacks are now going to be studied as an historical event for the first time by college freshmen in America, right. You know, something they weren't even alive for.
Okay.
Do you feel that that has happened with Aberfan in a way, that it's been consigned to history and is no longer relevant to the culture of Wales?
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. And I'll tell you, that was another funny thing about the conference, is that I felt like I was writing a historical novel. And I tried to stay away from the village as much as possible, out of respect, because they will get inundated before the 50th anniversary. But also, because I wanted it to be historical fiction, and going to the conference made it feel like it was yesterday, and that was very difficult for me. You realise that it, in historical terms, it was yesterday, and people are still living with this. And I spoke to a gentleman recently who said, who's very well connected with the people from Aberfan, and I think he said in the region of 47 parents are still around, and it just brings it home how this was recent history.
Absolutely, yeah. That's incredible. What do you think the lasting legacy of Aberfan is for Wales, even today?
I think, unfortunately, the lasting legacy, as I see it, is really one of guilt, because Aberfan was let down, the villages of Aberfan were let down in a number of ways. Vincent Cain talked about this at the conference, and I couldn't agree with him more, that we let them down in so many ways. The NCB were not held accountable in any other way than just in the inquiry, and the Fleet Street were writing sensational stories which would have undoubtedly hurt the villagers, and the Welsh press were very quiet about it. In a way, Harry is the fictional journalist who does perhaps what a lot of journalists look back and think, I wish I'd done that. I wish I'd stood up and said, how dare you treat these villagers like
gives
that.
Gives a voice to those who perhaps couldn't speak up at the time.
Exactly, yes. And then in terms of the removal of the tips, George Thomas, Secretary of State, he went along with the idea that the money to remove the tip should come out of the disaster fund, which was an extraordinary thing. And Vincent Cain made another good point, that if George Thomas, Secretary of State, had said to the Prime Minister, no way, you're not taking that money out, that's the NCB's responsibility, Harold Wilson would probably have agreed and said, OK, it's a silly idea. But and I do think Vincent Cain was right in that as well. So in terms of Welsh history, I think a lot of people are starting to look back already and feel guilt and a little responsibility.
Mm-hmm. You research your works very thoroughly, and what struck me most, it's very similar to one of my favourite non-fiction works, In Cold Blood, in the way that Truman Capote kind of engrossed himself in the town itself of Holkham at the time. That was a really revolutionary piece of work at the time. Do you feel that your work is kind of similar to that in the way you approached it?
Yes. It's an interesting way of doing it. And Truman Capote was criticised by a number
everyone
of people.
Everyone, as a matter of fact.
Yes. for doing that. But I like that approach. Mm. I like that non-fiction novel idea. So I'm definitely going to carry on with that. But I am bracing myself for... But I think that's why I'm quite relieved that people are saying it's investigative journalism meets historical fiction. Because maybe nowadays we can say it's that genre rather than Truman Capote's non-fiction novel, which didn't go down very well.
Yes, yes. Fantastic. And that was Louise Walsh, author of Black River. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A very interesting interview there, talking not only about the press integrity and whether or not they were intruding and whether or not their methods of reporting this were wrong or immoral, but also talking about the voice to the victims, something that if you read up more about Aberfan, you will find out that some would say they were treated unfairly and that this was a scandal. For more information on Louise's book, you can go to blackriver.cymru. Her book is also available to buy at Waterstones and on amazon.co.uk. All details are available in the description. With thanks, of course, to Dan Hurd, Welsh Language Coordinator here at Express Radio, for interviewing. Big thanks to Luke James for his production and technical assistance. And music, of course, by Francis Lindgren. He's available on YouTube and SoundCloud, links in the description. Think Tank is a free and independent podcast recorded at the studios of Express Radio in association with Cardiff Student Media. For more information, go to expressradio.co.uk. To end the podcast today, we're going to play one of Amy's songs. This is her charity single, Remembering Abavan. We were lucky that she recorded this for us live in the studio after her interview. This is Amy Goddard with Remembering Abavan. Her music is available at amygoddardmusic.co.uk, and it's also available on iTunes and Apple Music.
Okay, yes. So you just want me to go?
Whenever you want.
He didn't want to go to school today. Knew that he would rather stay and play. There are many lessons he must learn. There is only one more day of term. Reluctantly, my boy went through the door and stumbled up the hill to school once more. A little late, but class had just begun. Oh, I wish I hadn't sent my only son.
Come.
to me. Oh, my tears, they flow free. My tears, they will ever flow free. He didn't want to go to school that day. And how I wish I'd kept him home to play. 50 years have passed and I am old. Still this story seldom one I've told.
Think Tank is available on SoundCloud, Mixcloud, iTunes, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. For more information, go to habbl.co/thinktank. That's habbl.co/thinktank. Thanks for listening.